Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. In this podcast series, we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated, replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I'm your host, I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economics PhD, former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. Prior to that, I worked in policy and finance, and my expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. My guest today, which I'm delighted to introduce, is Gloria Bouillon. Gloria is a distinguished aviation strategist and advisor renowned for her expertise in the U.S. aviation system and global aviation markets, with a track record in shaping the future of the aviation industry. Gloria is a pioneering figure in the realm of advanced air mobility, renowned for her unwavering dedication to community integration, stakeholder engagement, and transformative business strategy. She is the CEO and founder of Aviatrix Advisors, a firm grounded in her extensive background as a consultant in various capacities within the U.S. aviation industry, creating strategic alliances to effectively improve infrastructure and regional economies. She has managed and developed two airports. She has a deep understanding of community dynamics and extensive experience in facilitating dialogue and collaboration between local stakeholders and complex airport development projects. And as an aircraft owner and commercial instrument-rated pilot, she's passionate for aviation and mobility and passionate about fostering the growth and mentorship of women in aviation and other underrepresented groups. Additionally, Gloria's work as an advisor guiding startup innovative and emerging companies in the aviation and aerospace industries is quite impressive. So, Gloria, welcome to the podcast. Delighted to have you here. You have a wealth of experience in both the public and private sector, and I've only touched upon it on our introduction. And so in our conversation today, I would like to explore with you two broad topics. One, how innovation is beginning to transform air mobility. And two, the challenges and strategies for air transport infrastructure and city infrastructure. So let me start with the tech side. One of your areas of expertise is advanced air mobility. Can you tell our audience what we mean by advanced air mobility and what the main benefits for the aviation ecosystems and for society at large are?
Absolutely. That's a good question. And when we discuss challenges, it's where do I begin? And I shouldn't say it on that note, but I'm going to discuss it more on the infrastructure development side, public planning type of side as well. So when we talk about advanced air mobility, we're looking at innovative solutions for what we see as development, and I'm going to call them vehicles. So eVTOLs, such as electric vertical takeoff, eCTOLs, such as conventional takeoff, electric systems, and then eSTOLs as well. So that would be short takeoff, all electric. We are seeing now some hybrid solutions, also hydrogen fuels. And now we're seeing some of these eVTOLs that were purely eVTOLs, electric driven propulsion systems, now moving a little bit towards the hybrid solution models with sustainable aviation fuels. And so when we're looking at advanced air mobility, we also bring in the concept of regional air mobility. So transportation of cargo and or persons throughout the region, urban air mobility, which would be in urban city centers, more urban centralized within those the cities themselves. And so, and of course, autonomous flight vehicles themselves, drones, other uses of those applications, which we're really seeing take off in the industry and kind of transform as we've been seeing, which was at the beginning of this start, hundreds of companies, hundreds of prototypes, and now we're seeing a convergence of really the dominant players, the key players that are developing their actual vehicles themselves and having them tested and going into different markets for scalability and practical uses that we're seeing come out of this. Another component of it would be the systems themselves. So within the ecosystem of advanced air mobility, the vertiport development. I'll discuss a little bit. The vertiports are intended to be multimodal transportation systems. So really focused on the seamless passenger experience, being able to purchase a ticket through the app, go through the vertiport itself for the multimodal systems, such as the modes of transportation, the first and last mile, and then continue that seamless passenger experience, either in urban centers or potentially in other areas such as remote locations. That's where we're seeing some of the vertiport discussions and companies looking at operating, or in certain areas such as New York City for that type of operation. And again, that's...
So multimodal, Gloria, so meaning that you give me, you offer customers a seamless experience where there is the airborne part of the journey combined seamlessly with land-based.
Yes. And for the vertiport and airport, actually, airports are moving into this as well. So looking at it as a multimodal, so how do you get there either by bus or typically buses or trains or other systems with electric charging facilities, so and fast charging facilities, and then tying it into really the electric part of the mobility infrastructure, as well as it's encouraged to be the seamless passenger experience. As we know, going through some of the major hub airports or even as smaller hub airports, there really is, it can be a pretty stressful experience. And so looking for a quicker turnaround for that entire experience in itself.
And we're coming out of the holiday period, so I think a lot of our listeners, like myself, are probably recently scarred by the traveling experience in airports.
I was saved of that this year, yeah.
And it is interesting because maybe it would be great to hear your perspective on this. Often we see a lot of new technology coming in, and certainly you mentioned the experience in airports and the importance of multimodal experience for travelers. And airports have been deploying different technologies, but often with very limited positive impact on the customer experience. Now, some of it is because demand for travel is increasing. Some of it is because there are humans involved in it, and so perhaps some of the deployment of the technology is a bit suboptimal. But you're an expert in airport management. What is your perspective on how we can actually leverage technological innovation to improve the customer experience?
That's a good question. Many of the original concepts of the advanced air mobility innovative solutions, in not just when we look at the ecosystem itself, so also within the industry, it was really to benefit the society as a whole. And when we look at reduction in carbon footprint and then reduction in congestion and other areas where we're actually now seeing, and of course the companies, the startup companies and or companies that are currently developing product solutions in AI autonomous systems that also encompass not just the aircraft manufacturers, but they're also airfield solutions, airlines are employing them, and other companies that are developing solutions that not only support the AM industry, but we're also seeing that change throughout the airport itself. So, for example, airfield solutions and training initiatives, inspections. So where you can increase efficiencies, operational efficiencies, reduction in the workload, potentially reduction in the actual cost of what it may take for human training versus something that's a more autonomous training and models. So you're really seeing a huge influx in that type of technology driven, where of course there are FAA standards that require various milestones and or human elements to that part of the requirement. But as an example, I'm part of the South by Southwest Board of Advisors, and I evaluated almost 100 startup companies in aerospace and defense applications, also aviation, emerging technologies. And I would say about 75 to 80% of those were all AI driven. We saw a lot of, this also goes into aviation, but VR and augmented reality uses that we're seeing a massive amount of startups that are developing solutions. And of course, with that, a lot of those will be kind of fed out as as either they gain momentum or other solutions take place. But it's really, I would say, all encompassing in terms of how the industry is evolving. And it's not just supporting the advanced air mobility concept and portion of it, but it's also supporting current operations and current industry practices now.
Excellent. Of the various advanced air mobility solutions you mentioned earlier, three or four key examples, which ones do you think are going to develop at a faster pace? Which ones are we most likely to experience directly as regular customers in the near future?
That's a good question, because a lot of the certification timelines have evolved. Originally, it was 2024, 2025 benchmarks. And now, of course, we're seeing that number change to potentially later on and closer to 2030, potentially. So and now with the way that we need to think about it is, if an aircraft is sitting, it's not generating revenue potentially. So the use of the aircraft, the way I look at this is, it's not replacing the current modes of transportation. How do these vehicles and other technologies that come out of this, how does it coexist with the existing? So legacy carriers, they're not going to be replacing this. We've seen letters of intent of partnering with a lot of OEMs. And so taking on certain market segments, that's the exciting part, is the part in which certain cities or areas in the world, such as the Middle East, et cetera, that will be used more for the scalability portion of it, the usability portion of it, where there's potentially less regulation and or cities that are ready to accept the adoption of these vehicles and services, and they can operate and start operating. So that's where I think in the US, it's going to be different, and it is already different as far as implementation of where they operate, which cities, and then scalability.
This actually takes me to another related area that you have a lot of expertise in, which is the complicated process that is required to build and maintain infrastructure, which is needed for air mobility, traditional and advanced. And as I understand it, especially with the benefit of the previous conversations you and I have had, here is where you have an ecosystem of local decision makers involved. So can you walk us through how all these decision makers interact, how important and how difficult it is to build consensus for the different steps of building and maintaining and upgrading infrastructure?
Yes. So this is one of the areas that I see as one of the biggest challenges, honestly. And you can have a lot of these companies ready to go, and you may not have a city or an area or the infrastructure available to support those operations. And so you see a lot of these startups and OEMs and companies, private companies, typically move at a record speed pace compared to government organizations. And I can say that because I've worked in both the private and government sector. And for example, so I am a consultant for airport planning projects. And when you look at the planning process for any type of development in a city, you start the planning process years in advance. So not only do you have to have a planning document saying this is what justifies and supports the development of this particular infrastructure. So I'll give you an example of a runway, or building and constructing or maintaining a runway. There has to be planning documents and justification that support the requirements of that runway. So based on aircraft size and other factors of weight and usage for that particular runway. And so then not only do you have the planning portion of it, but then you have the environmental process you have to go through. That's also, and then local requirements. So an example, when I was previously director at my last airport, we were located in three jurisdictions. So one planning project for a fence, was a smaller project. And I had to go through three jurisdictions because we were located in three jurisdictions. So just the Conservation Commission meetings alone, instead of it being four meetings or so, it was about 16 meetings, just the Conservation Commission meetings for approval. And then you have also planning departments, engineering departments, and then mayors and city, and that's not including the city public presentations. And that's not a controversial project generally, is a fencing project. But then when you look at something like advanced air mobility, where you're looking at either vertiport development, which I actually have my thoughts on, of using existing infrastructure instead of building new infrastructure because of the incredible cost and capital intensive environment that aviation is in. So, and in addition to the zoning requirements and challenges that would have for vertiport development. So if you're looking at vertiport development on airports, on existing infrastructure, I think that's where really the focus should be, because they're already operating, they're capital intensive, but they're already there. So developing those spaces on current infrastructure. So the project, one single project could have a life cycle depending on the amount. Short-term is 1 to 5 years. Long-term is 1 to 20 years. The use of pavement should be about 20 years. There's incredible amount of detail and requirements that go into a planning project before you even bring in the local requirements. And then we do see some airports that have shut down, have stopped receiving grant funds based on the community perceptions. And so it's really, I would say, a big hurdle, because these cities may be ready to go and operate. So when you look at some of the cities that are successfully operating these already, this has been in development for a while, because it takes such a long time to address the community. And it would be in the same process in which you would bring the community in for any development project, to explain. It's not just putting a technical report in front of a community member and expect them to understand it, particularly when you're looking at new systems such as urban air mobility or advanced air mobility and some of these eVTOLs, because time and time again, we see safety come up as a concern from community members. Noise, pollution, is it really? And also that's great, but not in my backyard. So it really takes a massive amount of momentum, not just from the airports and cities, but also to gain an understanding from what the community wants. And if they don't want it, it's not going to happen.
So lesson number one, I guess, is if at all possible, make sure the project is within one jurisdiction. So at least you avoid the problem of multiple layers of discussions. Can you give us some example of a specific project? You mentioned cases where this has been in the work for a while and it's starting now to take off. Can you give us a success story?
I look at Beta Technologies. So they are in Burlington, Vermont. And I think I've flown in and out of that airport a bunch of times because of my own aircraft that I fly. But it's a perfect, I would say, case use study. There are, of course, the other OEMs as well, but they're in a mountainous terrain area. It's an airport that can be able to develop because it's more of a regional airport, I would say, in terms of they have commercial service, but it's not a massive, they're not in a very restricted airspace itself. So the operations can be supported. It's a perfect case use study in which you do have, it's more remote in terms of geographically located. So when some of the remote applications of advanced air mobility are looking at these areas in which are more, I would say, remote compared to other city or urban uses. And so that is one of the examples I use typically.
I'm curious also, as you mentioned, it takes quite a number of years for these projects to go from the initial planning stage to actual execution for a number of good reasons, including the safety concerns. So there are a lot of boxes that need to be ticked. And now I'm looking at it also from my perspective as an economist who's always concerned with forecasts. So this long planning process must make it a lot harder to look ahead as you start with the project and you're trying to figure out what the needs of the community will be, what the economic impact will be. What's your sense of how much of a problem this is? As I'm guessing, part of me says, well, in any case, you're building useful infrastructure. So even if your forecasts are not precisely correct, anyway, it will contribute. So how much of an issue is a difficulty in forecasting so many years ahead?
So the good thing with the FAA is that they, whether you have higher demand areas, and so based on the numbers driven out of, for example, the forecast that will define pavement areas, what is necessary, or when you're looking at the space requirements, the best possible uses for those spaces. So forecasting for those areas, one of the reasons I'm a proponent of using is existing airfield spaces and existing infrastructure is because of the highly capital intensive requirements for any type of pavement or infrastructure development. The uses of the pavement and the space requirements, you look at it as what could best be used and best be served here. So even if it's not necessarily, so some of these OEMs where they don't have necessarily a long-standing business in which when you evaluate them coming into a community or responding to an RFP or being developed on the airfield, some airports may be lenient in signing a long-term lease with some startup essentially. And so some of the benefits of potentially partnering with other private companies on an airfield, for example, could be for a shorter term lease, and you still are able to generate jobs. You can bring in other, you can build the facilities such as the manufacturing where it's being tested, the prototypes are being developed. And so you're still able to make use of those spaces, and it may not have as a major revenue generating standpoint as some of the other traditional revenue generating businesses would, where they have a longer standing or a longer term lease, et cetera. So it's still able to support the community of these positions, these OEMs, et cetera, where it's not just purely an economic standpoint. So it's the STEM developments, research and development. It's bringing on other technologies that can support those into these communities where, again, if they're looking at some of the smaller communities, that is massive for those communities that are looking at it as a workforce development standpoint.
We mentioned the revenue generation, and you have experience in running airports. So I'm curious, what are your lessons in terms of what it takes to successfully plan and execute a business model for an airport, including diversification, revenue generation, the funding challenges? How difficult is it, and what's the best way of getting it right?
Well, fortunately, I mentioned before I was a consultant before I became an airport manager and led and developed the airport. So the first airport that I came into, they were actually the city council and the administration, I would say, not was because of previous practices, the airport was not self-sufficient, was not generating enough revenue. And they were, when I was hired on, I was brought in while they were undergoing essentially a feasibility study to either not decommission, but to potentially look at it rezone for residential or private use or something that would completely cut it off from funds. That's challenging in itself. And so because I had this background in being forecasting and going through and analyzing data and how looking at best uses of spaces and where the deficiencies were, I was able to quickly define that they were operating at about 16 times less than they should be in ground leases alone. And so it wasn't a popular decision in terms of what I was bringing on, whereas a lease negotiation, but immediately started diversifying the revenue, bringing a massive amount of attention to that airport. And so increasing the grants, working to develop a master plan. So again, those are what drives the forecast and then the development infrastructure in that. And I took that same method and approach with the last airport I developed and managed. They were also looking at decommissioning and reconstructing one of their massive, so the primary runway, because it didn't have enough use. And so it would have forced all the corporate operators to vacate. So massive amounts of job losses. And again, I went through the data and actually found that the forecast driving the essential decommission or reconstruction to much smaller widths was actually based on very old numbers and not the current demand for that particular type of aircraft, what was being used. And so I was able to gain the support of the FAA and the state as well in transforming that from an airport that was about to really face a demolition and loss of almost everything when you look at businesses, jobs, et cetera, into an expansion project. So they said, okay, let's drop. Wow. And then...
That's quite a turnaround.
Yeah. And then I did that with the properties themselves, which were also being previously sold off. I called developers. I said, this is invaluable land. And then I turned that into a waiting list for developers, for technology companies, looking at other companies that don't just serve aviation, so manufacturing, et cetera, where I could place them for the best uses. And so looking at changing how an airport could typically operate, where you're looking at a lot of these airports that I've done previous studies for, a lot of them are trying to figure out how do we survive? How can we support our maintenance, because it's extremely expensive to operate airports, and just not only the staff, but the systems themselves. And so a lot of them are, I would say, hanging on the brink of being able to even receive FAA funding. And so revenue generation is usually very challenging for many of these smaller airports or airports that are underserved in rural communities.
Which is remarkable and very important, because something you said points to the important role that airports play in local economic ecosystems, right? Because it's transportation, so it has a massive impact on the potential economic development, economic activity, manufacturing and services and otherwise of a community. So it sounds from what you're saying that it's we tend to look at it, or at least I've always looked at it more from the perspective of how are manufacturing and economic location decisions driven by the availability of infrastructure. And what you're pointing to is the other side of the coin, which is facilities like airports also taking a more proactive view of their potential engagement with the local economic ecosystem. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's part of the education part too, is gaining support from the political entities. So that was something that I did as well, joining chambers of commerce, meeting with city council members so that they understood, and that's part of the education process, that they understood that particularly with an expansion project where it's highly controversial but brings in a massive net benefit to the community economically, from jobs, from tax revenue, etc. So it kind of having that support from particularly all communities was very important, because you also had constituents that you had to have approve of an expansion process that can be upsetting. And again, it's similar to the AAM operations when you're bringing in new businesses to support the ongoing and businesses and or airport, but it may not always be, usually they're not always viewed in the best light. And I would say that's more just from everyone's various standpoints.
It's very interesting, because we're in a situation where, from an economic perspective, especially in the U.S., we've started from a situation of economic activity being heavily concentrated in some specific areas, especially on the coasts, and with some of the areas in the middle of the country being hollowed out by a decline in manufacturing. But now, over the last several years, we've had almost a counter trend, because there are other innovations, including in advanced manufacturing, including in communication and education, that are facilitating a more even spread of economic activity and therefore of opportunities, and therefore a more, let's say, a more efficient access to resources from the point of view of economic activity and access to opportunity from the point of view of the population. So it sounds like your field, which is the development and managing of aviation infrastructure, is playing right into this, which is very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And you brought that the coastal airports and cities, a lot of them on both sides, are very confined in space. And so when OEMs and other companies are looking at growth and development, also the high cost of operating or potentially locating your company on a coastal area where the cost may be a bit higher than looking at somewhat in middle America, where we're seeing the availability to develop the larger spaces available is to develop. So looking at putting your operation in and developing your operations in those areas where you can really develop a market segment, you can be able to scale up essentially.
This is how important of a constraint is energy? I'm thinking of both energy availability, energy cost, because we're in a situation where we're in the middle of an energy transition, everybody wants more energy. Now, the AI companies would like to take all the energy for themselves. So I'm wondering, in the case of this kind of infrastructure, how does energy availability come into play?
Yes. So again, airports and airfields are highly energy, require high amounts of energy. It's very expensive to operate facilities. I think, if I can remember correctly, just for one runway alone, it was probably around 40 to 50,000 a year or so, if I can remember from the lighting itself. Yeah. So when you're looking at other types of energy sources, such as renewable energy sources, those are great, but they also require, if it's solar, they require quite a bit of land. And then it's most likely going to still have to be supplemented by traditional sources of energy. And so I actually did work on a solar lease power purchase agreement, which was very complicated in Massachusetts, but still driving towards that method of use for energy, particularly if it's renewable power energy. But still, because there's such the facilities are so highly energy demand with infrastructure and then the charging themselves, those are technically challenged and looking at still sustaining it with traditional energy sources.
Yes, essentially where you can augment them with renewable energy on site.
Exactly.
But necessarily, you always say, as in most cases, need a traditional energy backup because you do need the energy to be available all the time, not just when the sun.
And you have to have redundant systems as well. So
Exactly. Gloria, we talked about the different speeds you work with, the private sector, the public sector, startups, and you've pointed out that all of the startups you work with tend by the very nature to move very fast, at a much higher speed than their public sector counterparts. So how do you help them navigate this differential speed and also, like I say, a cultural difference that comes with it?
Yes, I have advised for various startups in the past. And one thing that I have to keep honing in on is when you're in various stages of startups, almost any stages of startups, it's going back to the core of first, of course, when you're looking at investors, but who is on your team? Who are your advisors? Who are part of your board? How can you leverage their industry networks and connections? And a lot of times, some of the most successful startups I had, and that was sometimes with defense or military applications. And so a lot of the fallacies that I've seen are when you try to spread yourself too thin by serving every market, trying to be located in almost every market, and yet you still don't know the demographics or what market conditions or who your actual user is going to be. So trying to be everything and everywhere is a massive fallacy and something that understanding your market segment, understanding who your users are, and then develop. So for example, your prototype, instead of developing multiple lines of it, understand the use cases for it, best use cases. And then right now it's how can you stay in the game long run? And it's survivability right now. And then of course, scalability and at some point profitability. But right now I would say the biggest hurdle is moving at paces in which the industry doesn't move at and it hasn't, and they're making, you know, much further progress, I would say. But from the private development standpoint, I have to continually say, well, you know, there's a process for this. There are a lot of steps, procedural steps to go through. to, you know, when you're looking at trying to locate in a particular area. And so it's similar to many of the startups in terms of how to define your product, know your product, but it's also in the aviation industry where it's incredibly, again, capital intensive, and it's staying in the long game. So how are you going to adapt? Again, so the certification timeline has changed. So how are you going to adapt with that? And of course, in America, we're seeing business case uses, cities that are developing the ecosystems, but it's not, I think, the initial thought process of we're going to be in every city operating in urban mobility center or in city centers. And so now it's identifying where you can operate successfully, where you can start scaling up with those operations. And again, looking at the Middle East and China and then certain AM friendly cities in the US that support those. So it's very similar to the same type of startup advice that I would look at for other startups in various industries.
Very interesting. And now, Laura, if you, for a second, unburden yourself, forget about all the complications, all the regulatory approvals or the complicated administrative steps, and let's look forward anywhere from 5 to 20 years and give us an unconstrained picture of what the future might look like. How will advanced air mobility change air transportation? How will it change urban mobility? What does the world look like 20 years from now?
Well, that's interesting because initially the concept was, it's again, like I said, it's going to be operating everywhere, replacing what is currently in use now. But we're already seeing massive amounts of companies adopting solutions in AI and other areas of autonomous systems that, again, we're not, I would say, in traditional type of technologies, particularly in this industry. And so as we're seeing the what's been happening with some of the changes, it's forced the industry to look at how have we operated and how can we be more efficient. And so I think that's really exciting when you look at particularly in infrastructure systems on airports. So how can you build smarter airports in the infrastructure? How can you plan for that? And again, long-term planning process. So for the long term, I think it's quite exciting where you can see the practical applications, and it's not just a lofty vision or goal, but you can actually see it coming into play practically. And I think it also will go into other areas such as general aviation and areas where there hasn't been a massive amount of change. And so I think it will work hand in hand very nicely as you're looking at, it's not replacing these systems, it's going to work with the current operations and then augmenting what we have.
So my travel experience 20 years from now will be better.
Yes, I can say that for sure.
Excellent. And we'll find out how much better and how exactly it will change. This is going to be a very fascinating journey. Gloria, we've covered a lot of ground from the ins and outs of the infrastructure, the building and maintaining of infrastructure, the work that is being done in cooperation between startups and public authorities. Before I let you go, is there anything that we have not covered and should have, or any message that you would definitely make sure our audience takes away from the conversation?
Actually, that's a good question. But I think, again, a message to, because I've seen so many startups, again, would be going back to know your team, know your product, know your market. And like I said, sometimes it's that one client that you need, that one paying customer that can you can win, and you're good for a while.
Excellent. And I think based on our conversation today, I think anybody who is working on developing new solution in the advanced air mobility space should have understood that you are a resource they might want to consult and take advantage of, if possible.
Absolutely.
Well, what's the best place to find more about you online, Gloria?
Actually, I started Aviatrix Advisors LLC after my previous position with airports. And so people can find me on my website, just Aviatrix Advisors, or on LinkedIn. And I'd love to connect and either figure it out from there what the solution is that people need.
Awesome. Gloria, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you for a great conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, Marco.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Please check out this season's new episodes. Keep coming out. They are very exciting in the area of new scientific advances, the space economy, unidentified aerial phenomena. We have a lot of stuff that you should be very interested in tapping into. So keep following as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. You can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite place for podcasts is, and you can always learn more and apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.